We're in the 27th chapter tonight of Isaiah. Now, if you folk decide that you want to be studying something else and don't want to study this, it's all right with me. I love the book. I think it's worthwhile. It's the greatest of all the Old Testament prophets. It deals with basic principles that govern God's whole entire rule and control of mankind. So I think it's worthwhile. I know if you've never studied before, it becomes a little difficult. I know that. But you just let me know whatever you want to do, and we'll always do that. Now, in these four chapters, 24, 5, 6, 7. That's right, four chapters there. Is that right? 24, 5, 6, 7, yeah. Now, those deal with a universal or world judgment. Now, in chapters 13 through 23, we had the judgment of individual nations. Now, these four chapters deal with an overall world judgment that points out God's judgment of idolatry and wickedness. And these things must be destroyed, even in the life of a nation or an individual, before he can enjoy the spiritual blessings that God's provided for him. Now, this is what I consider one of the major lessons of it. Now, in the 24th chapter, that dealt specifically with the world judgment, the great city, the haughty people and all that. God would bring them down. Then, in chapter 25, you have three hymns of thanksgiving, and another one in chapter 26. There are four hymns of thanksgiving unto the Lord for what he does for his people. Then, in the 26th chapter, you have the glory of God for his righteousness. Now, in this one today, chapter 27, we have here the overthrow of world power and God's rule in his people, his kingdom, as over against the other. Now, this is a contrast that God keeps before us all the way through the Old Testament. The contrast between the wicked and the righteous, and how that idolatry is primarily responsible for the condition in his people. But here, wickedness on the one hand, righteousness on the other. Wickedness is always judged and defeated. Righteousness always is triumphant. Well, that same principle now is found in the New Testament. But you're dealing with it back here from a different point of view. It's the nations back here. It's the individual over here in the New Testament. So maybe that will help us to see what we're trying to point out here. Now, in chapter 27, in that day. Now, always when you have the expression in that day, that's dealing with your context. Now, what did we have just before that? Right, in verses 20 and 21, he says, come, my people, enter thou into thy chambers, and shut thy doors about thee. Hide thyself for a little moment until the indignation be overpassed. In other words, here are the judgments he's been talking about. Now, those that are faithful to him, you hide yourself from all of this, that is, in him, hide yourself in the Lord, for this will only be for a small moment. Now, of course, 100 years, a few hundred years is a small moment in comparison to time. But behold, Jehovah cometh forth out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also shall disclose her blood and shall no more cover her slain. That is, her wickedness and murder will be exposed. And she will be judged by that. Now, then, that's the day. In the day of his judgment and all of that, what God does, in that day, Jehovah, with his hard and great and strong sword, will punish Leviathan, the swift serpent, and Leviathan, the crooked serpent, and he will slay the monster that is in the sea. Now, notice, first of all, is his sword. It's hard, that is, it'll not break. It will accomplish his purpose. It's great. It's great enough to accomplish the purpose he has in mind. And it's strong. It's strong in his hand. Here's a hard, great and strong sword. And with it, he'll punish Leviathan. Now, this word Leviathan, I believe, occurs 6 times in the Old Testament. Twice in Isaiah, twice in Job, and twice in the Psalms. Now, the word means a mythological monster. Now, we talk about a dragon. There's no such thing as a dragon, and we all understand that. And so when the Bible talks about Leviathan, it's talking about a mythological monster. Now, the people understood that. They knew what he was talking about, that he was talking about some great force that God was going to destroy, that he called Leviathan. Now, you'll know there are three. Leviathan, a term of serpents. Leviathan, the swift serpent. Leviathan, the crooked serpent. And he will slay the monster that is in the sea. Now, I don't think that means any particular kingdoms or nations. I think it's like Revelation. In Revelation, you have the beast out of the sea, symbolic of political power. You have the beast out of the earth, symbolical of religious power. Now the harlot, symbolical of that which appeals to the lust of the flesh, the eye, and the pride of life. That is, that which is sensual. Sensual and devilish, that kind of a thing. Right? So, as those three are represented, that represents the whole of Satan's methods of attack. Here is force, here is false religion, and here is worldliness or lust. The lust that appeals to the individual. Now then back here you have Leviathan, the swift serpent, the crooked serpent, and the great monster. Simply symbolizing all that stands in opposition to God and to what is right. And God will destroy, all of these will be destroyed by the divine power. Alright, so that, now that's in the day that you're going to judge and do these things we've just been talking about in chapter 27. Now here's another in that day. In that day, a vineyard of wine, sing ye unto it, Jehovah and its keeper. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. Wrath is not in me. Would that the briars and thorns were against me in battle. I would march upon them. I would burn them together. Or else let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me. Yea, let him make peace with me. In days to come shall Jacob take root. Israel shall blossom and bud, and they shall fill the face of the world with fruit. Now, that's of course a parable, a figure of speech. Now look back with me to another vineyard that God talked about back in the 5th chapter. Now you'll notice the difference in these. Now in this vineyard in the 5th chapter, in the first 3 or 4 verses of it, now let me sing for my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard in a very fruitful hill, and he digged it and gathered out the stones thereof and planted it with the choicest vine and built a tower in the midst of it, and also hewed out a wine press therein, and he looked that it should bring forth grapes, and it brought forth wild grapes. Now notice the figure there. The song is in praise of the beloved who planted the vineyard. Now that parable of back there refers to the Hebrew, the old national nation. God brought them out of Egypt, brought them into the land of Canaan, planted them there as his vineyard. Now the praise here is to the planter of the vineyard. But when he came to look for fruit, which he had a right to expect, he found only wild grapes. Now he goes on to say back there, and now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, betwixt me and my vineyard. What could have been done more to my vineyard that I had not done in it? Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes? And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up. I will break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down. And I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned nor hoed, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that the rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of Jehovah of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. And he looked for justice, but found oppression, for righteousness, and behold a cry. Right, now that's what he found in the physical nation, the old Jewish nation. Now here in the 27th chapter, this now is looking to the planting of the spiritual vineyard. And in this, the vineyard is the thing that is praised here, the vineyard, instead of Jehovah himself. In that day, a vineyard of wine, sing ye unto it, unto the vineyard. I will read this again. I, Jehovah, am its keeper. I will water it every moment. God will be constantly care for this vineyard. He'll make every provision in the world for it, for its growth and for its development. He has done that. This we've been pointing out over and over in our study of the New Testament, ever since I've been here, that God has made provision for all of our needs and necessities and cares for us and everything essential. So spiritual growth and development has been provided. God said, I'll water it every moment. Lest any hurt it, I will keep it night and day. I will look after it. Wrath is not in me, because this vineyard is a true spiritual vineyard, and there'll be no wrath in Jehovah against the vineyard, as there was back there. That means that those that constitute this vineyard are those that are righteous, those that serve God, those that are spiritual. Right? Would that the briars and thorns were against me in battle. They were to come against me in battle, then I would march upon them, I would burn them together, or else let them take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me. Yea, let him make peace with me. Now, under this new dispensation, for them that is against God, let him make war against God, or let him take hold of Jehovah and serve him. Let him do one or the other. And that's the way it is. Jesus said, he that is not for me is against me. He that gathereth not with me scattereth. So you're either on one side or the other. There isn't any middle ground in serving the Lord. We either serve him or we don't serve him. And if we don't serve him, it means we're on the other side. We're against him. And so if an individual is against him, let him come upon me in battle. I'll take care of him. But I'm going to water and take care of this vineyard, and it'll bear fruit. And notice what the fruit, notice he goes on to say here, in verse 6, I let him make peace with me. In days to come shall Jacob take root. It doesn't say how long, but in time to come, generation to come, Israel will blossom. In those days Jacob will take root, Israel shall blossom and bud, and they shall fill the face of the earth with fruit. That is the fruit of the Spirit, spiritual fruit. And so it's not limited to Palestine, it's universal. And you'll find the fruit of righteousness being produced by God's people wherever they are. They're producing that. So you see a contrast between the vineyard and the planter in chapter 5, and the vineyard and his planter in this chapter 27. Right, so now when God is judging the wicked here, to punish them, that's when he's going to establish his kingdom, plant this vineyard that will bear fruit. So it's a contrast between the world and the spiritual here, and one of them is against and judges it, and the other one stands. Now he moves on here. Now, not only must the world be destroyed, but also physical Israel must be taken out of the way. That must go. Now, hath he smitten them as he smote those that smote them? Now that's a difficult passage. Hath he, that is God, smitten them, that is Israel, as he smote those, the enemies, that smote Israel? No, the smiting is going to be different. Now notice. Or, it says it in this way. Well, are they slain according to the slaughter of them that were slain by them? Now, what he's saying is, in that, is God going to slay Judah and Israel as he slew the nation that has slain them? No. Now that's pointed out in Jeremiah 30 and verse 11. God says, I will bring all the nations, whither I have scattered thee, I'll bring to a full end, rather, all the nations whither I have scattered thee. But I will not bring thee to a full end, but I'll chastise thee in a part there. Then back in Isaiah the first chapter in verse 9, he mentioned the fact there that here is a remnant that's going to be saved. There's a remnant that's going to be preserved, and also in the 10th chapter. Now notice here in verse chapter 1 and verse 9. Except Jehovah of hosts had left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom, and should have been like unto Gomorrah. So God is not going to completely and totally destroy the Jews as a people. Now he's going to destroy them as a nation, as a kingdom. He's going to destroy them as that. But he will not destroy them as a people. They will always exist. There will be a remnant of them. Now here over in the 10th chapter, and verses 20 and 21, or 21 rather. Yeah, 20, 21. And it shall, chapter 10, 20, 21. And it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel, and they that are escaped of the house of Jacob, shall no more again lean upon him that smote them, but shall lean upon Jehovah, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. Now the one they leaned upon in Egypt and Assyria, God, they won't lean on them anymore. A remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them shall return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness. For a full end, and that determined of the Lord Jehovah who make in the midst of all the earth. That is, make a full end of them as a nation or a kingdom. But I'll not make a full end of them as a people. We see that, don't we? The old kingdom that was destroyed has never been rebuilt. Now, a bunch of Jews are going back to Palestine. But they've never restored the Davidic kingship. They've never restored the Levitical priesthood. They've never rebuilt the temple. Not a Jew knows of what tribe he is. The tribal relationship was brought to an end with the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the genealogical tablets or tables they had kept. So no Jew knows of what tribe he is today. But they're just as distinctively Jews as they were when God destroyed Jerusalem. You just look at them on television. And when one comes out, just got the map of Jerusalem all over his face there. You can tell every one of them. And you ever notice that nearly every one of these lawyers that defend criminals is a Jew? Do you notice that? You just watch that. Most every one of them got no principle. And most every one of them that defends criminals is a Jew. I've observed that. Well, all right. Now, come on back to my lesson here now. All right, so here then, but so what the point of those two verses is, that first verse, so in measure, when thou sendest them away, thou dost contend with them. He hath removed them with his rough blast in the day of the east wind. That's Jehovah, and what he's going to do with his people. Now, in measure, when you send them away, therefore, by this shall the iniquity of Jacob be forgiven, and this is all the fruit of taking away his sin, that he maketh all the stones of the altar chalk stones that are beaten in sunder, so that the Asherim and the sun images shall rise no more. Now what he does is, when he brings back a remnant, they are no more the idolaters. God's going to break down these altars as chalk stones, break them in pieces, be cast away. When the Jews came back from Palestine, now later on, they did imbibe the Greek philosophy and mix that up with our religion. But never did they worship an idol. They've never been idolaters, as far as a physical idol is concerned, since God just carried them away into captivity and brought back the remnant. Now that's what he's saying here. He's going to bring them to an end as a nation, but not destroy them as a people. When I say nation, I mean a kingdom. He's going to destroy them as a kingdom, never as a people. They'll always be Jews, but they'll never again be idolaters. They may worship money, they may worship something else, but they don't have the idols. They don't turn to them. God destroyed that within them. I think that's the point there. So now verse 10, for the fortified city is solitary, a habitation deserted and forsaken like the wilderness. There shall the calf feed, and there shall be he lie down and consume the branches thereof. When the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off. The women shall come and set them on fire, for it is a people of no understanding. Now notice up here, it's a city, the fortified city, has a people of no understanding. What would that mean? That means that this city, God's going to destroy it. The city of the Jews, the whole headquarters will be destroyed. It's a people of no understanding. The Jews never understood Jehovah. They never did. Strange, isn't it? They never understood what he was doing with them. That he was using them to bring a redeemer into the world, make them his people, but they never understood the difference between a righteous life and a formalistic worship. They're going through the form. They seem never to understand, and don't yet. They still don't know anything about God. They're practically atheistic, most of them, even orthodox. Don't have a perverted concept of God. They still think they're the people of God, but if they stop and think what kind of a God God is, then they would know they're only his people as they do his will. They don't do that. Well, all right. I got nothing against Jews, particularly, except against God. I've got a particular love for them. As a people, a race, got nothing against them. I like to say one of them converted. It sure would help the world a lot. I'll turn those Jews to Christ. I'll save you a whole lot of wickedness and corruption going on. Don't you ever notice this? Most all of the comedians on television are Jews. You ever notice that? I don't understand why. They don't come from that kind of a background in the Old Testament, as far as we know. Now, maybe they did. I don't know. Maybe that's why they never served God, never understood God. They're always making fun of everything, but I don't think so. I don't think that was a character back then. They're strange people to me. Always have been. All right, so now he moves on down here. A people of no understanding. Therefore, he that made them will not have compassion upon them, and he that formed them will show them no favor. Now look at the whole paragraph there from 1 to 10, or 7 to 10. And what he's saying is, he's not going to destroy them as they destroy those that have destroyed, that have oppressed them. He's going to destroy the nation where they scattered them. But I'll never bring you to a full end. But I'll chasten you in measure. I'll destroy your city, that is your headquarters of your whole religion. That's going to be destroyed. But you'll always be a people. Always. And they still are. And will be. And so, but I'll destroy your city. And I don't think he means just Jerusalem, the city itself. I think he means the headquarters of that whole entire system. And then when I've done that, this is a people. I'll destroy the people as a kingdom. For they're people with no understanding. Never did understand God. And when Jesus Christ came, they still didn't understand God. And they've been rebellious against him ever since and still are. So these people who say the Jews will someday be converted to Christ and go back to Jerusalem, I'm making that argument directly in the teeth and the face of all the scriptures that said, besides the evidence of all history and the characteristics of them today. Now, they'll never be a converted people. I wish they would. If they would be converted and turn their zeal for the cause of Christ, they'd turn the world upside down again. All right.
Now, here's the end gathering now of the outcast. Now, the city going to be destroyed. The people, I mean the nation, the kingdom, will be destroyed as a kingdom. The system of religion, the headquarters, that'll be destroyed. Now come the end gathering of the outcast. And it shall come to pass in that day, the day now of judgment, the day of destruction of the Jewish system, and all of that, in that day that Jehovah will beat off his foot from the flood of the river unto the brook of Egypt. Now the river was the Euphrates. So from the river Euphrates to the Wadi El Arish, that's the river of Egypt, not the Nile. But it's the Wadi, it's the boundary between them. A little river that flowed north in Mount Sinai that was a border between Canaan and Egypt. It wasn't the Nile. Sometimes the river means the Nile, but not in cases like this. Wadi El Arish. From the brook of Egypt, and ye shall be gathered one by one, all ye children of Israel. So now then, to beat off the fruit is a figure from the olive tree. Now here's the olive tree, and you put your cloth down under here, and you got there, and you beat it, and knocks off the fruit there. So God will gather his fruit from all over the world, but he's going to gather them one by one. It'll not be national. And people ought to understand that, but they don't. He said it's going to be one by one. God's going to be selective. He'll be selective of his people. Who will he select? Those with faith, who repent, turn to him, and serve him. These are the ones he'll select. Now, that's what we're talking about in the New Testament. Period. And it shall come to, O ye children of Israel, and it shall come to pass in that day that a great trumpet shall be blown. Now that's symbolic. For back in the Old Covenant, when they had a holy convocation according to Joel, they blew the trumpet. And when they prepared for war, Numbers 10, 1 to 10, they blew a trumpet. When they were ready to march, they blew a trumpet. When they introduced certain festivals or feast days, they did it with the blowing of the trumpet. And that's what he talks about here. Might be a literal trumpet here, but the blowing of God's trumpet, which is the gospel of Christ. The great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come that were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and they that were outcast in the land of Egypt, and they shall worship Jehovah in the holy mountain at Jerusalem. Well, now that holy mountain is the mountain of the second chapter. Here then the law shall go forth from Jerusalem, and the word from Zion here, and all nations shall flow unto it. Many people shall go and say, come, let's go up to the mountain of Jehovah, the house of the God of Jacob, and it will teach us of his way, and we'll walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of Jehovah from Jerusalem. And Jehovah will sit and judge among many peoples. They'll beat their swords into plowshares and so on. Now in Hebrews 12, the writer said, now you come unto Mount Zion. You come unto the city of the living, the heaven of Jerusalem, the city of the living God, under innumerable host of angels, under the general assembly and church of the firstborn who enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to Jesus Christ, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaketh better than that of Abel. So you see, we have, according to Hebrews 12, and that's about verse, I think, 21 or 2 on through 26 or 8, we've come unto that. I wish the prophet back here was speaking. And that which he prophesied you'll come unto, we've come unto that. And there's not another one after a while. Charlie gave me a paper that came out of the church box, and on the front page were pictures of two men. One of them, a man that I've known since I was a little boy, six years old. Very dear friend to me back in those days. He used to follow me around just like a little puppy follows his master. And I just loved him. I stayed in the home there when I grew up. I had a preach that 60 years ago, 55, 60. Now he's a man in about 60 now. He's going off after premillennialism. He's charismatic at the baptism of spirit. He's introduced instrumental music into the worship and all of those kind of things. Now, showing here what the extent to which people can go in all of this here and worship God in the holy mountain. Now, he's gone beyond that. He started out there, but he left it. It just did something to him when I read the article by him and about him there. And I knew him so well and loved him so dearly back on many years ago. But anyhow, here's the holy mountain. That's what I started to say about him was, now he's a millennialist believing that God has something else after a while. Christ's going to come back and set up a kingdom and rule in Jerusalem. But when God very positively says here that the mountain will be established, the writer of Hebrews says you've come unto it, and if you've come unto it, that was God promised back then. What else is there? Only heaven. That's all. Beyond this is heaven. But our brethren, I didn't realize our brethren had gone, I knew they'd gone a long ways. Another boy in there, I hadn't classes back home in college. But he's the one that plays the guitar for the Church of Christ out there in California and leads the music there. He's the one that looks after that, the instrumental part of it. So our brethren now going off into all these things. The great number of the church going into apostasy. It's completely apostatized in the old faith. I know we live out here, and I live over Tucson, not associated with those things. Once in a while I get these papers. You can't realize what's been going on in the last 25, 30 years. How far the church has departed from the old paths. Faith. One step forward. Well, anyhow, I'm going to start the next night. Covers these four chapters. Great chapters. A world judgment. Hymns of praise to God for what he does. The fact that God's going to destroy the wicked and the wickedness of the world. That's going to come to naught. And Jewish nation will be destroyed by judgment. But he'll establish, he'll plant a new vineyard. And this vineyard will bear fruit. And this will be a people he'll gather one by one. And these will be his people. And that's the New Testament church. God has that. We've come to that. And we ought to be thankful to God every day for what we've learned and what we have and what God has done for us. What he made of us. That he's redeemed us. He called us by the gospel. Accepted us. Redeemed us. Added us to that family. Planted us in his day. And there he expects us to bear fruit. Well, let me move on into the next chapter, and I'll cover what I can out of it. That covers that section, that verse 28 to 35. Now, here is another section here, warnings, dealing with Jerusalem's Zion. Warnings and promises. Now, you've got some great warnings to them and great promises. Because remember, Isaiah prophesied over a period between 40 and 50 years. So there will be changing conditions. And so you'll see a change in his preaching from time to time. The early part of it. First 12 chapters are probably the days of Ahaz. And probably this last section that we've been dealing with, from 13 to here, probably in the days, that's a universal. The beginning now with 28. Now you're probably in the days of Hezekiah. Most likely this deals with Hezekiah and his rule. Now here are six woes. Now back in the fifth chapter, we had six woes back there. And then a seventh in the sixth chapter, when the prophet said, "Woe is me." Now you have another six woes here. A little different from those. Those dealt with one period of the history and what they were doing. This is another. Just like I've lived now in 6 years, been preaching in the church, I see such a tremendous change in condition today and condition that they were when I began preaching. That demands and necessitates a different type of preaching, a different emphasis than when I began preaching. Now let's look at this. This first one is a woe upon both Samaria and Jerusalem. Woe to the crown of pride of the drunkards of Ephraim, and to the fading flower of his glorious beauty, which is on the head of the fat valley of them that are overcome with wine. Now, Samaria was the capital, here is Samaria now, and the city of Ephraim, rather, were the drunkards of Ephraim. Samaria was the capital. You recall, here came down here's Jerusalem over here, and up here is Samaria. Now, here was a dividing point here, somewhere along about here, the dividing point. Now here then is Ephraim, and here's Samaria the capital. Here is Judah, and Jerusalem the capital of it. Right, now what he's talking about, these drunkards, that are the ruling folks of Ephraim up there, who are given more to wine than they are to looking after their work. Now notice he said, "The crown of the pride of the drunkards of Ephraim, to the fading flower of the glorious beauty." Now this Samaria here was located on a kind of go up a valley. Here was a valley that came up here. That was a beautiful valley. And here on the head, on the hill here, was a wall about it. It gave the impression of a crown. So here was a city with a wall about it, and looking at it up the valley, it looked like a crown on the head of the valley. Right, that's the figure that he's using in this when he said, "Woe to the pride of the drunkards of Ephraim, and to the fading flower of his glorious beauty." That's a crown, a garland of flowers, it looked like there from a distance. Which is on the head of the fat valley, the fertile valley, of them that are overcome with wine. Behold, the Lord hath a mighty and strong one. Right, now that mighty and strong one is in all probability Assyria, because he used Assyria to destroy Samaria. About 722:01. Behold, the Lord hath a mighty and strong one. Now notice how you're going to have the threefold description of it. As a tempest of hail, a destroying storm, as a tempest of mighty waters overflowing. Now here then is a hailstorm, mighty wind, and here then is the flood waters that follow it. Now Assyria was likened unto overflowing flood back in the 8th chapter, if you recall, probably don't. Verses 5 to 8 there, here was Samaria as an overflowing flood coming over the land even unto Jerusalem. But didn't take Jerusalem, coming to the head of it. Behold, it hath a mighty one, a destroying storm, a tempest of mighty waters, overflowing will he cast down to the earth with the hand, that is the hand of God. The crown of pride of the drunkards of Ephraim shall be trodden underfoot, that is by the conquerors. In other words, it's God's hand using the Assyrians as the conquerors who were treaded underfoot, treaded down. And this little figures like this God uses all the time. But it's his work. He simply uses these instruments to accomplish the work. Now he moves on, and the fading flower of his glorious beauty, which is on the head of the fat valley, shall be as the first ripe fig before the summer, which when he that looketh upon it seeth, while it is yet in his hand, he eateth it up. Now that's, here's the figure. Now, you have the figs in Palestine. You have one group that got ripe in the spring, early summer, the other in the fall. After an individual had gone through the winter with no fresh fruit, when he finds that ripe fig, then he eats it voraciously. So that's the figure here. Here is the Assyrians, and here is Samaria, as the first ripe fig, which you grab and you devour it quickly, so he would devour you, Samaria, at that time. Now, it's a figure they would understand, and we understand it when we read it carefully here. All right, I look at the one, eat it up. In that day, now here's another expression, in that day, will Jehovah of hosts become a crown of glory and a diadem of beauty under the residue. Now the residue is the remnant that's left of his people, and a spirit of justice to him that sitteth in judgment, and strength to them that turn back the battle at the gate. Now, I want you to note that. Now, here was to Samaria, here was the crown of a beauty at the head of this fat valley. Now, when God destroys, the hand of God casts it down, and his hand will be the Assyrians. And the Assyrians will trot it underfoot, and then they'll recognize Jehovah then for what he is and who he is. They'll recognize him as the crown that they should have looked to. He was the crown, and not the city ruled by a bunch of drunkards. But the residue, the people will recognize it. They will recognize him, the remnant that is spared. All right, he'll be their strength to them that turn back the battle at the gate, or else defending it at the gate and will turn back. It's uncertain which. And even these reels now. Now that's 1 to 6 is Samaria. Now beginning with verse 7, he now turns to Jerusalem. And he said, and even these reel with wine and stagger with strong drink. The priest and the prophet reel with strong drink. They're swallowed up of wine. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. Now the prophet was God's spokesman, and the priest was the one who taught the law and offered the sacrifices of worship. Now God forbade the priest to drink wine when they were serving at any time there. Now here your prophets and your priests in Jerusalem are reeling and drunken with wine. A very ugly picture. Look at the picture here. It's a very ugly picture. Swallowed up, and the priest and the prophet reel with strong drink. They're swallowed up of wine, they stagger with strong drink, they err in vision, they stumble in judgment. For all tables are full of vomit and filthiness, so that there is no place clean. Now suppose here we break into the door here, and here are the prophets staggering around here, in a drunken stupor, trying to tell what God has said. Here are the priests over here, they're drunk, and here's a table. And the table there is a symbol of spirit, of one spiritual food. Now here's a table here, it's covered with vomit here. You can't, no drunken guy, you can't find a clean place here or clean spiritual food in the whole outfit. That's the picture painted here of the priests and the teachers and the prophets of God's word and of God's law here. And here they are drunken and reeling around and falsifying and teaching, and the table of spiritual food there is covered with the vomit of a bunch of drunk sots. Not a very pretty picture, is it? Well, Isaiah gets to paint one. He painted a good one. One thing I like about him, he can make you see what he's talking about. Now he said, now here's what the drunken guy said, and Isaiah comes in. Whom will he teach knowledge? He's trying to get the picture. Here these fellows staggering around half drunk. Whom will he teach knowledge? Whom will he make to understand? Make to understand the message. Them that are weaned from the milk, and drawn from the breast. Who are you trying to teach, a bunch of babies? Well, we're smart, one. We're priests and we're prophets. He ain't got anything he can teach us. And so, whom will he teach? The little babies here, weaned from the breast? Boy, it's precept upon precept. Get a rope teaching. Precept upon precept. Line upon line, line upon line. Here a little, there a little. I've heard men misuse that passage. They'd go back there and use that passage. They were God was teaching here. The way he was teaching, line upon line, line upon line. Precept. No, it's a bunch of drunks mocking the prophet. I heard a colored fellow preacher with a Tucson here a few years ago. Well, I know him down there, but he's good friends with that. He used that to teach He said, whom will he teach? Said, well, them that are drawn from the breast. Said, you know, you can't keep baptized babies because they're going to have to be older than that. Here, you're talking about here, who are we going to teach? Well, them that are drawn from the breast there. And so that leaves babies out there. But he could have missed it any farther. I sat back, I said, Tickle, I didn't think I contained myself. And those fellows just sitting up there listening to him, no, he's smart. He got a passage there against infant baptism. He knew more about what he's talking about than I did. Forgot on Einstein's theory of relativity. Not a bit more. But it was interesting to listen to him anyway. All right. I don't know what I told him after it's over. I don't think I told him much. I couldn't compliment his sermon much. All right. So now he moves on here. This is what the drunks were saying. They were drunk. And you just hear, from whom would he teach knowledge? Whom would he make to understand? The babies? Them that are drawn? Why, just a bunch of babies. Just sound like a rote teaching. ABC, over and over again. And look at the prophet's answer. And the prophet says, nay, but by men of strange lips and with another tongue will he speak to this people, to whom he said, this is the rest. Give you rest to him that is weary. And this is the refreshing. Yet they would not hear. So yet they would not hear, he says. Therefore shall the word of Jehovah be unto them precept upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little, there a little, that they may go and fall backward and be broken and snared and taken. Now, so Isaiah turned the thing around. He said, no, he's going to speak to you with men of strange lips and tongues. Now, God said back in the 28th chapter of Deuteronomy, that if you don't keep my law, I'll bring a people against you from a far country whose language you will not understand. And that's what he's saying now. I'm going to speak to you with a people of language you won't understand, but I'm going to speak to you in deeds of destruction. You'll understand that. Then you come to understand what he's talking about. You know, a lot of folk can only learn something like that. You've got to knock them down a few times to get the point. That's what God's saying to these people here. And so this is the way you're going to do it. And it will be line upon line. You'll learn it that way, all right. You'll learn line upon line, precept upon precept, how to turn that thing right back upon you. And you'll fall backward and be broken and snared and taken. Now, wherefore hear the word of Jehovah, you scoffers, that rule this people that is in Jerusalem. Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol are we at agreement. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it shall not come unto us, for we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood have we hid ourselves. Now that was what the people's answer. We have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol are we at agreement. I don't think I'm going to have time to teach what I want to on this passage here. I want to use up my 45 minutes, but let me finish up the tape. Now I'm going to start here and talk about this next time. This is a great passage here. Now, the people said we made a covenant with death. They had sought to make a compromise with Assyria. When that didn't work, they went down and made a covenant with Egypt, expecting Egypt to help them. So therefore, they were not afraid of what would happen to them. So they sent money to the king of Assyria to try to buy him off. He kept the money, but it wasn't bought off. He still came against Jerusalem. So they made a covenant with Egypt. So they said, we've made a covenant with death, and with Sheol are we in agreement. And the unseen one. So when the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it will not come unto us, he says here. It will not come unto us. Under falsehood we did ourselves. Therefore, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not be in haste. I will make justice the line and righteousness the plummet, and the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the water shall overflow the hiding place. Your covenant with death will not stand. I want to talk about that, so I'm going to stop there. I'm going to stop there with that next time. But the point is that to those people, God was the stone in Zion. Peter quotes this in 1 Peter 2, 6 to 8, and applies it to Christ. So Christ is the stone in Zion on which we build. Jehovah was the stone, the tried stone, that on which they were to build. So it both had an immediate application to a present condition and also looked unto the future fulfillment in Christ. And you have three times, I want to notice the three times when you can apply this. So I'm going to stop there. My time's up. Don't keep any later. Take another 15 minutes to say what I want to say. So we'll stop there.